Welcome, welcome to Rewriting the Wrong Way, the podcast where we talk about a lot of things. And today, though, I am going to answer questions. So I usually talk about writers, how writing works, how writers work, how the best writers risk being strange. I often interview people on this podcast. If you're new to the podcast, you'll notice that it's mostly interviews lately. Although I used to do a lot of these solo episodes. In fact, historically, the solo episodes are the most popular ones. I don't really understand why, frankly, but just personally, I don't like them as much. So I don't tend to do a whole lot of them of late, even though, you know, technically that's what people always ask me for and seem to respond the best to. I think just because I think it's less has to do with me and people wanting to hear more from me. I don't think that's the case. I think it's more that those podcast episodes tend to have really focused topics and they're very niche down, and therefore they've got particular search terms and you just have an accidental, I think, popularity to them over the interview ones where we're, you know, they're on different variety of topics. So today I want to kind of do a bit of both things. I'm going to do a podcast where I answer your questions. I put out a call on social media and in my email newsletter, just, you know, talking to people for some questions, you know, what are just anything. I ask any question, silly or serious, ask it, and I will give you not just an answer, not just, you know, my opinion, not just, you know, somebody. I'm not doing this thing that sometimes people do where they're like, well, you know, it's just what I think, but there's other ways to answer the question. No, this is the definitive answer for all time. Your questions definitively answered for all time on any topic. And so this may not be a long episode. We'll see, I guess, how they go. I'm going to try to keep it relatively short and give you some short, snappy answers to your varied and strange questions. So, Paul Friesen asks, any question? Well, Paul, you found me out. I wasn't being 100% genuine because, yes, it's true, I will answer any question, but there's one type of question that I won't answer. So yes, I'll answer any question, but I will not answer any knee question. A knee question, I won't be answering any questions about your knee. I'm afraid you have to go somewhere else. The next question comes from Sarah Jane. Sarah Jane asks, why is my name Sarah Jane? Well, it isn't. I can tell from your question that it's not. So that's the answer to your question, Sarah Jane. Why is my name Sarah Jane? The answer is that it is not. Zane. Zane has a question. Zane asks, if a tree falls in the woods and nobody is around to hear it, does it make a sound? This is a classic question, a Zen koan. This is a considered an unanswerable question, but I am here to give you, as promised, the definitive answer for all time. So if a tree falls in the woods and nobody is around to hear it, does it make a sound? Yes, if a tree does fall in the woods, if it did fall, it would make a sound. But according to many interpretations of quantum mechanics, until it is observed to have fallen, the tree didn't fall. It's in a sort of a Schrodinger's cat state. It's not until the observer comes and retroactively, or rather, you know, in the present moment when the observer comes and sees that the tree has fallen, at that present event, retroactively, that observer observing the fallen tree selects retroactively the past event of it falling as the actual event among the different possibilities that could have occurred. Now that that present sort of observer has come in and seen the tree has fallen, retroactively again, the past event gets selected as the actual event out of the varied possibilities. Therefore, after that present instance, when the observer notices the fallen tree, the sound of the tree falling will have occurred in the past. So that's sort of the answer to the question. Yes, the sound of the tree will have occurred in the past after it's determined that the tree has fallen. But of course, if there is no one around to observe the tree falling, it's simultaneously falling and not falling, both making a sound and, if in every possibility where it falls, it will make that sound, of course. But if it's not falling, if it's in a non-fallen state, it's not going to be making that sound. But, retroactively, it will have made that sound. That was the question answered for all time. We don't need to ask that question again, ever. Zen or not. Motion asks, how long did it take to get your first book published? This is a bit of a more straightforward, serious writing and publishing question. Motion, there's two answers to your question. How long did it take to get my first book published? Well, it depends how you define my first book. If you mean the book I wrote first, the first time I finished writing a book, then the answer is that it has never been published. But if you are talking, so I wrote my first book, I finished writing a book for the first time. It would have been in 98, 99, probably 99. But it was never published. And then if you're talking about the first book I did publish, telling it to take me to publish Ex Machina, which ended up being my first book, the answer is 3 years. That book took 3 years to get published. Strangely, I was sending it around from place to place for year after year. It's a very strange book. If you ever read Ex Machina, it's still in print. You can go find it. In fact, I think I'm still giving it away on the website as of the moment I'm speaking to you now. If you go to johnthenball.com, you can actually get a I'm going to change it so maybe by the time you're listening to this, you can't. But if you're fast enough, you can go get a free copy of my first book, Ex Machina, at the ebook for free at johnthenball.com. But also, it's still in print through Book Hug, who first published it, of course. And that book, did though take 3 years to get published because I kept sending it to publishers. Ex Machina is a choose your own adventure book of sorts. It has that choose your own adventure book structure, but the book is a philosophical series of poetic statements, kind of a lattice work of poetics, of poems, and poetic statements. And they're all sort of circling around a science fictional conceit, which is, that the poems are investigating what how machines have changed, what it means to be human. So, try to pitch that to a publisher, right? What I was doing was sending it actually to places, one press after the other. They were all rejecting it, but they kept saying the same thing. They kept saying, "We love this book. We think it's great. We think anyone will want to publish it. We are really invested in trying to publish books that, other people aren't going to publish. So we're not going to take this book, but we're sure you'll find another place to publish it. Good luck to you with this book." And I kept getting this bizarre rejection. Like constantly, people praising the book, talking about how great it was, talking about how much they loved it. And then saying, "We just know someone else is going to want to publish this book." And after like 2 years of this, I remember at one point I got a rejection. And in the rejection letter, the person, the editor rejecting it said, "Here's three other publishers that you could take it to. I'm sure they'll want Every single one of those publishers had turned the book down already. And I remember like thinking, like, "You guys keep saying, we just know somebody's going to want to publish this book. I assure you that nobody wants to publish this book. I just could not get anyone to publish this book. Finally, Book Hug did publish it. At the time, I had not sent it to Book Hug, actually, in my first few rounds of submissions, simply because at the time they had not been publishing trade books. They were really just a chapbook press. And I'd have to double check, but if I recall, Ex Machina was one of their first trade books. So it kind of, I literally got rejected so long that one of the publishers that I would have sent it to otherwise, like went from not publishing trade books to publishing trade books. That's how long, like they grew a whole publishing company, before I could even get one book published. So, you know, then of course they took it and they, you know, did a great job with it. And, you know, like I say, it's still in print. It's still one of my, book I'm really proud of that people still talk to me about, you know, to this day. A lot of people, for a while it was being taught by Derek Balyeu in his classes in Calgary, in his experimental writing and art classes. And people have done all sorts of weird things with that book. One person put it inside of a paint can, filled it with cement, and then threw it into the ocean. As part of their final project. So, before all that happened, you know, I was trying to get that book published for 3 years. Erin Bokbog. Erin, I guess, doesn't want to use her real, I know who Erin is. She doesn't want to use her real last name, but she's Bokboking around. What is your favorite sport? Well, Erin, Bloodsport, starring Jean-Claude Van Damme. Blood sport. That's my favorite sport. Jen Robinson. Jen Robinson has a question. What happens when an unstoppable force meets an immovable object? Well, that is very simple. When an unstoppable force meets an immovable object, then the paradox police get involved. And once the paradox police get involved, of course, nobody's happy. Now I have a bunch of questions here from Jessica Mayu, a friend of mine from high school. She has a host of questions. So anyway, I'll ask her all your questions, Jessica, just because you're great. You get more than one question. What is the best room to tweet from? Well, it actually may surprise you to learn that I only tweet from my office. I only tweet from my desktop computer in my office because I don't really like to tweet. I don't have Twitter on my phone. So when you see me tweeting, it's almost always a robot that's tweeting for me. So it's just my website is auto-tweeting or I've like drafted a bunch of tweets in advance and like scheduled them to go out at certain times. Or maybe I'm live tweeting, but I'm doing it just literally as a on a coffee break while at my office on my home computer. I don't have any social media on my phone. I don't like social media. I really, for the most part, the robots are tweeting for me. But if I were, so I'm stuck in my office. I have to tweet from my office because I don't really have another option to tweet from at this point. But that's not the ideal room to tweet. Your question is what's the best room to tweet from? So I don't tweet from the best room, which is my office. I tweet from my office rather than the best room, I should say. But the best room to tweet from, the ideal room to tweet from, would be a boardroom. During a meeting, when you're in a boardroom in a meeting, then you tweet. And then everyone else who's also on Twitter in the meeting, but not brave enough to tweet because they don't want to give themselves away, they see your tweet, but you know, they can't say anything about it because they don't want to be caught on Twitter and they're just kind of Now, they're DMing each other about, oh, can you believe this person's tweeting the meeting or whatever, even though that's what they're doing. And they're just kind of, you're the one who's got the balls to do it. That's the ideal tweet situation. Another question from Jessica Mayu. Is a mug considered a glass? No, a mug is a cup. What do you do? Another question. What do you do if you find a live wasp in your living room in the winter? What do you do if you find a live wasp in your living room in the winter? Well, I'll tell you what you don't do, Jessica. What you don't do is start shouting and waving your arms around. If you find a live wasp in your living room in the winter, do not start shouting and waving your arms around because that's the worst thing to do. The best thing to do is nothing, since it is obviously near death and no danger to anyone or anything and not an emergency. More questions, Jessica Mayu. Some good, diverse questions here. How do you tell salt and sugar apart if they're both in clear, unmarked shakers without tasting them? Well, it may seem like it'd be difficult to tell salt and sugar apart if they're both in clear, unmarked shakers without tasting them. But in fact, you can. Sugar crystals are shinier, more translucent, and less uniform in shape than salt crystals are. As we're talking, kind of the table salt. Of course, if you're talking rock salt, it's easy. But if you're talking about table salt, which I assume you are, I've forgotten your precise reference, but here's the real answer to the question. Sugar crystals are shinier, more translucent, and less uniform in size and shape than table salt crystals. More questions from Jessica Mayu. Where do babies come from? Storks bring babies, of course. Everyone knows that. And which one of your wife's friends is the greatest? Well, I know that you want me to say you, Jessica Mayu. And I will say that, but only not because you've coerced me into it, but only because you're the friend who actually bakes things and brings baking. Lee has a question. What do you do when you feel stuck with your writing? So this is more of a real writing question. I used to have a joke about, I still have this joke, but no one, I don't really do a lot of interviews these days. I'm going to start getting back on the interview train. Part of my purpose in answering your questions here is to get kind of warmed up in the interview train. But when you're doing interviews, of course, or just when people are asking questions, they always ask the same questions. And one of the questions is, where do you get your ideas? This isn't the question you've asked, Lee. You're asking, what do you do when you feel stuck with your writing? But the answer is the same. When people ask me, where do I get my ideas? Which is the question writers hate to be asked, by the way. So if you ever have a chance to interview a writer, don't ask that question. Now, Lee, you're not asking that question. I know this. So I'm just saying, the answer that I give, my kind of stock answer that I give is, I have three crows that bring me ideas. So I'm in my office here. If you're looking at the video on YouTube here, you can look up here and you can see there's these three plastic crows. So those are my three crows that bring me ideas. And the crows' names are reading, writing, and random. And so when I'm stuck, sorry, reading, research, and random is the name of the crows. RRR, reading, research, random. When I'm stuck, I go read something, specifically something in the wheelhouse of what I'm trying to do. I go research a topic related to the thing I'm trying to write. Or I just pick some random, just randomness. I just combine two things. I just randomly pick something to resolve the issue that I'm feeling stuck with. So I'll give you a couple examples. So I was stuck recently with my comic She-Wolf. So I kickstarted this comic She-Wolf. And to be honest, I prematurely kickstarted it a little bit. I felt like I had a really good handle on the story and where things were going to go. So I put the Kickstarter out. Kickstarter did well. It funded and everything. But then I'm in the position of Having fun. It's not, I got to put the book together, put deliver the book. Well, I kind of hit a snag because I had not finished the whole script at that point. And I thought, oh, I'll just bang it out. I know what's going to happen in the story. So, I did. I hammered out a pretty solid script, I thought. Then I started to take it around a little bit and get some feedback on it. So, I got feedback. A guy I ask for feedback a lot in comics is Chris Starros. So Chris Starros is the editor of Top Shelf Books. He's worked with Alan Moore. He's one of the, I think, if I recall correctly, he discovered Jeff Lemire. So he's doing a bit consulting these days. So I've been kind of consulting with him. So I got Starros to give me some feedback on She-Wolf, and I'm just thinking, it's pretty much solid. I'll get a few tweaks from him or whatever. Anyway, he kind of came back and he ripped me apart. He was being really nice about it, but he just kind of ripped it apart. And he was, I didn't agree with everything he said, but I could tell like he was basically right. I didn't have it really where I thought it was. And one of the reasons I knew he was basically right is because he was saying certain things. I mean, he was looking at a comic, but I had previously written a novella draft of the same basic idea. And I had shown it to a couple people, and my friend Adam Petrash had made a number of comments on it, giving me some, in-depth comments. And at the time, I kind of hadn't gone back to that prose novel yet. Adam had given me some good comments, and I thought, I mostly agree with this. I don't agree with everything exactly, but mostly I agree with it. Anyway, then I heard Starros saying he's looking at a different thing entirely. He's looking at a comic. He's not even looking at the same manuscript, but he's saying the same things, like some of the same things. And I'm like, ah, there's something at the core of this idea, because this is across two mediums now. I'm getting the same negative feedback, in with some positive feedback, but I'm getting like, these same comments. So I started to kind of, and then I'm on a deadline now, right? Like, I mean, I'm controlling the deadline, but I'm still trying to keep to the Kickstarter schedule, right? I want to deliver when I said I'd deliver and all this stuff. So I'm starting to feel pressure. I'm starting to get stuck. It's a perfect recipe for feeling stuck, right? You don't 100% feel confident in your story. You feel time pressure, right? And also I had just other stuff going on in my life. So, perfect recipe for getting stuck, and I started to get stuck. But I've been doing this for a while, and I started to recognize that I was getting stuck. So I thought, okay, I can't get stuck, right? I don't want to be pushing the schedule. Like, I can't get stuck. What am I going to do? Well, I'll go back to the three crows: reading, research, random. Okay. So reading. So the first thing I did with She-Wolf was kind of like, okay, I got to go back to like the roots of like what made me want to write this thing in the first place. So I went back to kind of like reading a little bit, kind of reading, rereading some of the core things that had made me interested and had given birth to the idea in the first place. So I didn't really 100% fully read them. I was kind of picking around, but I'll do it and I'm stuck. When I'm reading, I usually am pretty methodical. Like I'll pick a book and I'll finish it, then I'll pick a next book and finish it or whatever. That's why I like to read. But if I'm stuck or if I'm kind of doing researchy reading, what I'll do is I'll just skip around. Just because I'm just trying to unlock, I'm just trying to jar myself to remember something or to unlock something. So what I started doing was going back to some of the early comics that kind of inspired She-Wolf. So I went and read Grendel a little bit. Grendel was my favorite comic, Grendel by Matt Wagner. I went and kind of skipped through some of the Sandman, and I started thinking a lot about Constantine. Alan Moore invented Constantine, but then also Garth Ennis and a lot of other great writers had done some work with Constantine. So anyway, I started just kind of, getting more into con when I hit on Constantine in particular, I thought to myself, well, something with Constantine, So he was really into magic, right? He was effectively a sorcerer or magician. So he had, he had a supernatural aspect. And of course, one of the things with the she-wolf was I wanted her to have this kind of connection to the supernatural, but with a bit of the question of like how supernatural is she, and initially and so on. So anyway, I'm kind of thinking about some, I kind of snagged on the supernatural thing. At the same time, I'm doing research, right? So one of the things I had done in my research is I was watching and going through Alan Moore. I mentioned Alan Moore. I was going through his BBC Maestro. It's like this master class type thing. This Maestro class, this online course that Alan Moore was doing on writing. And in his course, Moore talks a lot about magic. And he talks about writing and magic. It's the gods of writing. We're also the gods of magic, like Thoth and so on. He gets into the tarot and those the suits of the tarot. You've got the pentacles, you've got the sword, you've got the cups, you've got these different tarot. So he gets into the tarot, he gets into magic, he gets into some of the ideas behind how these things equate to different concepts. So then I'm reading Alan Moore, right? I'm researching, or sorry, I'm reading Constantine. I was looking at more of the Garth Ennis Constantine, but Alan Moore did invent Constantine. I'm listening to Alan Moore, like researching Alan Moore's thoughts about writing and magic. I'm also researching because this. Then I started just literally researching magic. I just got some books on black magic and occult. I got the Keys of Solomon and all this kind of these esoteric magical texts. I started like researching through that, and I started thinking about my she-wolf story. And of course, the most important aspect of my she-wolf is Dante. This whole idea, the premise originally comes from Dante, because in Dante's poem Inferno, people forget this, but the main character Dante is he wakes in the middle of these dark woods, and he ends up going into hell. Why is he going to hell though? If you ran across the gates of hell in the woods, presumably you would not go into them, right? People always forget this part. There's a motivation, a reason why Dante goes into hell, because the woods are being stalked by the she-wolf, and the she-wolf is more fearsome than hell itself. He goes into hell to escape the she-wolf. He would rather go through hell than have to stay in these dark woods with the she-wolf. That's just sort of, I mean, there's all sorts of ways that connects allegorically to the thematic notions that Dante is playing with. But for my purposes, just the pure plot of it was sort of interest. What's the actual motivating plot moment, the catalyst sort of moment in the early plot of the Inferno? So, once I start, all that stuff is swirling in my head. And then also, I'm just making random decisions. So I'm just thinking to myself things like, well, what if Lee, what's something? One of the things that she does early on in the story is kill her husband or her, and so, or at least the guy she's living with. We don't know 100% if she's her husband or not at that point, but. You know that she's kind of has killed this guy named Kevin. And the story opens with her calling her dad and being like, the way that my comic opens is Lee's dad calls her. She's just sort of sitting up at night. Her dad calls her and he's, worried because he's what has happened in the backstory here is she's called her dad late at night But her dad was asleep and didn't pick up. But then he wakes up and he sees Lee's called her in the middle, him in the middle of the night, and he calls her back, worried something has happened. She, by this point, though, has calmed down. So, you have this interesting conversation that I kick off this comic with, where Lee's like, "Oh well," she goes, "it's," she's like, "Oh, I was just worrying." "Oh, it's nothing. I was just worrying." He's like, "Well, what happened?" It's like, "Oh, nothing. I just killed Kevin." And of course, he's like startled, shocked, but she's just being blasé about it. So I had that already, right? And then sometimes just random thing. I'm like, well, what's a random thing? If I bring her dad back in, which is something that they could be talking about, that would just be weird now to talk about. And I thought, well, again, the tarot. I was just, what if we just had the tarot? What if he's like going to buy her birthday gift? She's on the lam now because she's just murdered a guy. And he's like, "Well, where are you? Like, what are you doing? Well, I see you on your birthday." And she's like, "Oh, well, I don't know, maybe." He's like, "What do you even want for your birthday?" What if we just go into like, what kind of, again, I'm starting to get random, something like dads and daughters and things. I'm like, what's a normal sort of already kind of a normal problem that a dad daughter might have? And we add this insane level of your daughter is a murderess to it. Well, one just sort of everyday thing is like, oh, her birthday's coming up. What does she want for her birthday? Right. And why not add a deranged level to this? Like, he wants to get her something for her birthday, but what he really wants is, her to not have killed Kevin. Now he's gotta, get her something. What's he gonna get her? Who knows, but that's just sort of in my head. It's like, well, this is a random thing. What if he just gets her a birthday gift? Because I just, got my daughter a birthday gift a little while ago. And so I thought, well, what's she gonna get him? And I was like, well, what would she even want? Well, what if she wants a new tarot deck because she ruined hers? And I think, well, how does she ruin hers? Well, maybe she's killed somebody and blood got all over her tarot deck. But then I'm thinking, like, well, why would she even have her tarot deck out though if she's killing somebody? And then I clicked into, so what you're looking for when you're cycling around the reading and the research and just randomly thinking of things, like just weird random things, like, oh, well, I got, Jesse a birthday present the other day. What if Lee had a birthday present? You're just kind of randomly doing things. What you're looking for is the moment it all clicks. But you're not going to get to that point until you're just trying and poking away at things. You have to be doing the work of actually taking notes on what you're like doing all the stuff and taking notes and thinking about it and giving yourself the space. But then that random aspect has to come in. I often find it just has to click. What clicked for me with it was she the this feedback that I got and I'd gotten from Adam and from Chris Staros. Adam Petrush and Chris Staros, both of them had commented at different times and in different ways along the lines of, well, why is she doing this? Like, why is she killing these people? And of course, she's got me very, very, but I don't want her to have a pathology, per se. I want her to just have, she's killing different people at different times for different reasons. Yes, there might be some thread to it, but I don't want it to be like, super predictable. She has a type, anything like that. But it's still a legitimate point. Well, why is she killing this guy? Well, what if, again, I think of the tarot cards, she wants a birthday gift. What if she ruined her tarot deck? Is she going to, maybe get a new tarot deck from her dad for her birthday? Well, how would she ruin her tarot deck? Well, what if the reason she's killing this person is because she needs him to read her tarot? But she needs him to read her tarot as he's dying. That's the sort of magical position. Like, that's the alchemy. She needs someone who's dying as they're dying to pull three cards, past, present, future. That's the simplest way to read a tarot, is to pick a card for the past, card for the present, a card for the future. What if, you know, but, you know, because she's just slaughtered this guy, he's bleeding everywhere, he's dying. So he ruins the cards as he draws them out of the deck. And he dies. And what I love about that idea, when it starts to click, what I like about that is you can have the guy begging. Like, why? Again, asking the question the audience is asking. It's always nice to, if you can get a moment where the audience is represented inside of the text and inside of the story. So now I can have a moment where the guy he's killing is asking the question the audience is asking, which is why are you doing this? And her answer, of course, is like, I need you to read my tarot. Right? It gets to be a funny moment. It's also a bit of a page turn. Like, what does that even mean? Why? Then you can turn the page. You can see the tarot that he pulls. You get some foreshadowing, you know, and so on. Neil Gaiman, in one of his depositions in a trial that was going on with Image Comics and Todd McFarlane, I believe, was talking about one of the things you should do early in the story, like on the first issue or early in the early issues of a comic, is have, you know, basically a figure who knows more than the main character knows, like a seer sort of figure, right? Who seems to know the future. And Gaiman points out, well, one of the things that this does is it allows you to. It gives you like an author figure inside the story, and it basically sells the reader on the idea that you know where the story is going, even if you don't. But you need something like that. You need some foreshadowing so the audience feels, even though I have maybe a stronger idea where I'm going with the story than someone else might, but the idea that you need a foreshadowing moment in the first issue in order to kind of promise, like make a contract with the reader. Oh, I know where this is going. And you follow me, I will lead you somewhere, right? Just like in the Inferno, Dante is leading, being led by Virgil through hell. So it's a long-winded answer to your question, but this is what I do, and I feel stuck with writing as I do some reading. Do some research. I do some random decisions, and I'm kind of jumping from one to the other in that way. I'm trying to chain myself forward, because what I find is you start to kind of read around where you were originally inspired, like the kind of works that kind of were inspiring you or connected to what you're doing. You spring off that into researching some things you're noticing in those works a bit more fully, and then you spring off that into like just selecting some random element and making just sort of finding something that combines these things. And then you start to get a moment. Once you have a moment like that, I find you can really move forward fast at that point. You know, it really starts to click if you're kind of doing that work of reading, research, and randomness. Somebody didn't want me to. Didn't want to say their name, ask the question, what's your worst publishing story? You know, I don't have a lot of bad publishing experiences. I mean, I haven't always had the greatest experiences, but I've mostly been pretty lucky. I've mostly worked with very good publishers. In fact, I've worked with the best publishers, you know, people like Coach House Books and Book Hug and Heavy Metal. Probably the worst publishing experience I had was this one literary journal, which I mean, it wasn't a huge deal, but it was just kind of really annoying. So they published more than one of my poems. They published like five of my poems in the same issue of the journal. So I was really thrilled about that. But then they went and they spelled my name wrong 3 different times in the same journal. They spelled my name 3 different ways. And I was like, first off, I don't see my name being hard to spell. Ball. Like a basketball, you know what I mean? But yeah, they spelled my name wrong 3 times, 3 different ways, by the way, in the same issue. But that's, I haven't had too many bad experiences with publishers. Any bad experiences I've had with publishers, really, they're boring, banal bad experiences. Like, they're not unusual. Just like, standard nonsense. For the most part, though, I've been pretty happy with my publishers and have, just had great experiences with a lot of them. But, I'll tell you two sorry about my worst review, though. Actually, there's two reviews that I've had that's jumped to mind. So one was Politics of Knives got this review once. The review was, kind of mixed, but one of the things in the Politics of Knives, there's a poem called Kay Enters the Castle. It's obviously a reference to Franz Kafka's novel, The Castle, in which the main character's name is Kay, and he's always trying to get into this castle and he can't. That's what the novel is about. Very famous novel, very famous writer, Franz Kafka, etc. But in the poem, of course, I mention Count West West. So the poem sort of ends with Count West West in his, room writing. Now, the reviewer was like, "Oh, well, who's this Count West West?" This is what the reviewer had clearly done. So they did not get the book. They just didn't get it, which, fine, fair enough. They didn't get it though. So what do? They Google Count West West. Now, if you were to add Kafka or The Castle and Count West West, then what would you get, of course, is the novel The Castle by Franz Kafka, wherein it's correct. Like, I'm not making it up. Count West West is the stupid, ridiculous name that Franz Kafka gave the guy who owns the castle. But this person just typed Count West West and then didn't even go to, like, so what turns out if you just typed Count West West, at least at the time, was this writer of Harry Potter fan fiction who, for some insane reason, named himself Count West West. So why this person who's just dedicated their time to writing Harry Potter fan fiction would pick a handle based on a Kafka novel, I have no idea. But Count West West is apparently a writer of Harry Potter fan fiction. And so now this reviewer is like berating me because they think, well, it's so weird and annoying that this guy would, like, have a reference to Count West West and where he's Harry Potter fan fiction inside of, this weird, strange poem supposed to be a joke or something. It's like, what? Like, come on, dude. What bothers me about a review like that is not that it's negative, because, I don't care about negative reviews. They don't bother me at all. What bothers me is it's inaccurate factually. So to me, it's like, what are you doing reviewing my book? Like, you don't even have, like, the ability to review my book. On a fundamental level, you don't know what the book is about. So the other review I got like that once was a review of the National Gallery, which bit, by the way, these reviews were otherwise, had good qualities to them. And the writers of these reviews, I know exactly who these writers are. I'm not saying their names on purpose, but because they're not bad, like, they're excellent writers in their own right. They're exactly the kind of people who should know better and should know how to do better research. Because I know for a fact, having read their books, that they're great writers. So it just really kind of grinds my gears. But this other viewer reviewed the National Gallery. The review is great. So it starts from like the top to the bottom until you get to the last couple sentences. The whole review is super spot on. This person knows exactly what I'm doing. And they're just going through exactly how I'm doing it. And they are very positive. But at the end, they start to kind of dig at me. They start trying to criticize me, right? And they start sort of digging at me a little bit because, as they put it, they felt I was a coterie, one of a coterie of white writers who have these plush, plum academic jobs. So, first off, I don't have an academic job. I teach, you know, contract from time to time. I do like 4 months contract faculty stuff. I'm what you would call precariously employed, although it's not really true in my case because I don't care to be employed by anyone. I just kind of go to the university when I have nothing better to do, in the sense that, you know, I like teaching the classes, I enjoy that. And I do it when it fits my schedule. It's not my career per se. You know, I don't make hardly any of my money teaching at the university, but you know, I like to do it, so I keep doing it. But I certainly don't have, I'm like, you know, as employed as, you know, a hot dog vendor would be by the university. You know, I come there sometimes, do something and leave. You know, I barely, if I was, you know, as I was in the past, if I was now like I was in the past, trying more seriously to get into a position at the university, I would, you know, be right on that sessional treadmill with everyone else, because that's where I was. That's, you know, where I would be still if I hadn't, you know, just decided to go do other things. I'm like, I have zero political influence at the university, in academia, et cetera, et cetera. It's hilarious, and just goes to show how little you really know about me and my quote unquote coterie, to think that I somehow have some, you know, pull in anything and have any level of academic position. I have zero academic position. I have never even had a 12-month contract. I've never even had a limited term appointment, I should say. It was clearly a position. And I know, again, who the writer is. They're a great writer, by the way. But, you know, it was clearly, and again, it's up until that point, it's a great review. But it was clearly a situation. You could tell just by reading this article, this review, this person went into my book wanting to tear it apart, and they couldn't do it because it was too good. And this is exactly why I wrote the National Gallery, by the way, on one level. Like, there's, I got past this point, but initially, my goal, initially, when it started kicking off, I was like, I was taking all this criticism in Canadian literature because people were saying, oh, well, you know, he's just this experimentalist who just does this, just does that. You know, he's not really a serious, real writer in many ways. And I thought to myself, well, you know, I'll get past it to actually having a real point later on. Initially, my initial kind of kickoff was like, bet I could write a book where I can just prove that I can do exactly the kind of poetry that they keep saying that I can't do. In fact, I can do it better. I can do my own thing in that way. And then, you know, you can argue whether I succeeded or failed. I can point to books, parts of that book that I think are weak, relatively speaking, and other parts I think are strong. They're not the same things that, you know, being attacked or I should say pointed out in this review. But that review, up until that last point, was perfectly on point. You know, that guy knew exactly what I was doing. And it just very much, my speculation here is that he kind of came into it not wanting to like the book, and then was sort of dismayed how much he liked the book. And so just had to sort of try to undo it at the end, but with this ridiculous, falsity. Anyway, not a big deal. You can see I'm still kind of, annoyed by those two reviews. I've been pretty lucky with reviews overall, but those two kind of dug at me. The publishing, I've had some kind of, not great review experiences in a way, or ones that just kind of grinded my gears in that sense. But they're not, I don't have a lot of bad publishing stories per se. I'm just going to end it here with a question that wasn't really directly asked me, but I got a nice, every once in a while, I get a nice, for lack of a better way to put it, a fan letter from somebody. And so I got some kind of fan mail the other day, more or less, from Spencer Nadeau, who, had written to me in the past a little bit. But one of the nice things about, so Spencer had reviewed, he sent me a letter, but he also had noted in it that he had reviewed The Lightning and Possible Storms, my last book, my last big book, other than the, before I moved to comics recently, was The Lightning and Possible Storms. So also published a book hug, a short story collection that sort of doubles as an experimental novel. Anyway, so Spencer sent me a letter and a copy of the review that he wrote. And I wanted to end with this kind of question. In the review, so one, his reviews hit his headline for the review is, "Will any of us learn why?" So it's this question. And I thought, well, I'll answer a little bit Spencer's question, this kind of rhetorical question posed in the headline. So, will any of us learn why? Spencer, if you're listening, those of you who haven't read the book, the inscription, the dedication of the Lightning of Possible Storms, how books are dedicated to people sometimes. Well, the Lightning of Possible Storms, the dedication reads, "For Aaliyah, who will learn why?" Now, Aaliyah is not a person I know. Aaliyah is a fictional character inside of Lightning of Possible Storms. In fact, the next thing you're going to read, so it's the dedication, and then we get some epigraphs. Then, we have this little tiny story that kicks things off about Aaliyah, who's this waitress at this tea shop. And this author leaves behind his book. This author, Jonathan Ball, leaves behind his book called The Lighting of Possible Storms. Aaliyah opens it up and she reads this dedication that you've just read, "For Aaliyah, who will learn why." And so the book continues past that point. So anyway, Spencer's headline is a reference to this. Will any of us learn why? So it's a reference to this sort of dedication that Aaliyah, the character, reads inside the book. So Spencer is sort of, I think, in some ways, suggesting that question is not 100%, like, to what degree do we really, does Aaliyah learn why? Will any of us really learn why? So Spencer, perhaps it's hard to tell from exactly how you're writing and framing that question, whether you really caught on. The answer does, in fact, get answered. That question does, in fact, get answered in Lightning and Possible Storms. Like, you do determine why he has written this book for Aaliyah, or dedicated things. I can't say too much about it without ruining some of this, spoiling parts of the book for people. But I will just say for you, Spencer, and my brothers listening who've read the book, on page 184 is where you're going to find the answer. Page 184, that's where you learn why. But I want to end not with that question, but with another question that Spencer asked in his review. He kind of has this rhetorical question at the start of the review. He writes, "Canadian literature is tough to define. What makes a Canadian per se?" And then he goes into, just kind of talking about other things. So I do want to kind of just touch on that question a little bit, end things off here, because I don't know if Spencer, you probably do, but not everyone knows that I have a PhD in Canadian literature and creative writing. You're my sort of twin focuses for my PhD. So, what makes Canadian literature Canadian per se? It's a very good question. Now, historically, you get answers like the answer that Margaret Atwood gives in Survival, which she's kind of cribbing from Northrop Frye in many ways. Atwood and Frye kind of are arguing that Canadian literature has this garrison mentality, so that that early Canadian literature, or what they would call the beginnings of Canadian literature, you have the this idea that there's the fear of an empty and hostile Canadian landscape, and this kind of garrison mentality that develops in the settlers, and that therefore works its way into a settler literature, and so on. So that, of course, for a while is the answer to the question, at least as far as academics tend to be concerned. Later on, though, they kind of abandon this approach later on, especially in your kind of postmodern period. Especially, you run into this problem of defining Canadian literature, the problem of difference. Canada, on one hand, in this period especially, wants to celebrate the diversity of the nation, the diversity of the peoples within the nation, the mosaic, right? The whole cliche of the Canadian mosaic versus the melting pot of the States. At the same time, though, you have the very real, again, difference of the just largeness of Canada, and the fact that the different parts of Canada are so different and distinct from one another, that it's really, in some ways, and this is one of the core problems of Canadian politics and Canadian society, of course, is that, what is the two people in the same country, forget about racial and class divides. Even if you put that aside, if you live in Newfoundland, or you live in Vancouver, or you live in, the Paw, you are not living in the same country in many respects. It just is very little shared experience. Even if you don't get into things like race and class, just the bare geography of it. Never mind, the population, the size of the city, you're just getting so many, the weather, it's just so different that you get to this point where it's hard to really talk about Canadian and mean something. And of course, you also have this sort of anti-nationalist sentiment, where they're trying, on one hand, to have a nation. We still are engaged in a nation-building project in that period, in a way. But at the same time, it's a sort of weird anti-nationalist nation building. Well, what then is Canadian literature? What does it even mean to be Canadian, et cetera, et cetera? This becomes an academic question and a philosophical question. It becomes a cultural question. You get just sort of cliched responses to it. We have pop culture responses at a certain point, right? It's drinking Tim Hortons and watching hockey, right? Like, you get into that whole ad, Molson Canadian, I am Canadian, like that whole ad campaign. You get these kind of ridiculous mainstream pop culture attempts to define what's Canadian, but they're immediately ironized and become the butt of jokes and so forth. And then they start to kind of become self-referentially ironic in a strange way. So you have kind of this, strange attempt early on with, figures like Frye and Atwood to define Canadian literature with a really precise definition. They get very thematic. They have a really defined set of qualities that they're saying is common to Canadian literature. Quickly, we move past that and we get into the problem of people want a definition of Canadian literature, but they don't want a unified set of qualities. So it becomes just practically difficult. They're still invested in the idea of Canadian literature, But not in any sort of giving a definition. So what begins to happen, what I would argue happens, is that, and this is actually something I do argue in my book, John Pace's Crime Wave, where I'm not really talking Canadian literature, I'm talking about Canadian film. But in the after the last chapter of that book, I started getting into this argument in some detail. So if you have more of an interest in this, go read John Pace's Crime Wave, skip to the last chapter, perhaps, to get to this argument. But I argue that really what we start to get at a certain point is people just start defining Canadian literature against American literature. So instead of being defined by a set of positive qualities, the literature gets defined as lacking a set of positive qualities. So instead of, it being, X is a quality of Canadian literature, we say, well, X is a quality of American literature, where not Y, not X. And so what does it mean to be not X? It doesn't really mean anything, right? It's a kind of a negative definition rather than a kind of positive definition, in the sense of like there's not a positive quality, it's like negatively defined against it. This other literature that has particular positive qualities, or at least is figured to have particular positive qualities. And there's an anxiety around that. So there's, you start to get this, for example, in American literature, there's this, at least in the same, that period, you have this level of straightforward ambition. People are trying to write the great American novel, whatever. And then you have, at the same time in Canada, people literally making a joke of writing the great Canadian novel. In fact, Boyle, Harry Boyle, writes a book called The Great Canadian Novel, which is a satire of publishing, making fun of this idea that anyone can write a great Canadian novel, because the serious ambition that these states have just is not seen as possible in Canada. It's ironized. At the same time, I'll point out, someone like Boyle is really trying on one level through this ironic positioning to write the great Canadian novel. Like, is the level at which he's being straightforward and serious, but there's an ironic pretentiousness that starts to kind of come in. So you get this ironic pretentiousness to a lot of Catlett in that period in particular, where it becomes over-invested in its own importance, while at the same time it's very anxious about its own ambition. And it tries to play both ways. It tries to kind of make light of the idea that it would have something to say, while also, in a weird way, in the strange moments, being super seriously trying to say something. And I find that anxiety becomes almost the definable quality of Canadian literature. And it starts to become almost apologetically ambitious at a certain point, or and then apologetically unambitious, for me, at a certain point, it just starts to become annoying, frankly. So then you start to get writers like myself who don't really consider themselves to be part of Catlett. They start to separate themselves out in particular ways. They're trying to depart precisely from its tropes. I mean, I'm a pretty extreme example, but I'm not unique. But like, I'm an extreme example in the sense that what I'll often do is specifically the opposite of what other people are doing, for better or worse. And so, now I think I'm becoming a bit more normal in the sense that other people are sort of, it's just the things I'm doing are less unique than they once were in some respects. Not that I'm a trendsetter or anything, but it's just, I just think I kind of fit in a little bit more than I used to. Though it's not for, because I'm trying to, per se. But yeah, people like me who start to become, we just, although we have a, like, although I've got a real affinity for Canadian literature, like I said, I've got a whole PhD focused on Canadian literature, but as a writer, I have much more in common with European experimentalists and American experimentalists. You know, the European modernists and proto-postmodernists and American postmodernists are really my touchstones, rather than what we kind of call Canadian literature. Aside from this small subset of Canadian authors who never really did fit into the scene, people like Ray Smith. So that's sort of my little mini lecture on why Canadian literature is tough to define. Because it sort of has, by the time that we're talking about it today, it's kind of moved from a very clear definition that it used to have into this position of simply being defined against American literature. And then as I start to argue in John Pace's Crime Wave, although I'm talking about film, I think the same argument holds to a lesser degree when we're looking at Canadian literature, that what you start to get into is this sort of pastiche of American literature that starts to come about in particular moments. And to the degree that, and then it starts to kind of, in literature, I think, borrow genre elements. And what I think you start to see is that kind of a trajectory. So, in some respects, it's eliding the question. Yes, Canadian literature is tough to define. Per se, there's really not a thing that makes a Canadian other than a particular set of reactions. At least initially, a reactionary pose that it takes against or in response to Canadian to American imperialist cultural imperialism. And then I think, at least the work that interests me the most in Canada these days starts to then adopt a radical stance, reacting against the Canadian reaction against American literature. So that's a long-winded way, perhaps, of putting it, but I think that to me, that's the heart of the answer of the question. I've really enjoyed answering your questions. I hope that you've enjoyed it as well. I'm always happy to take your questions through email, social media. There's also some way you can apparently ask questions through Anchor. I don't know what that means, but I'm assured by the people putting this podcast together that it does work. So if you go to Anchor dot something FM, perhaps slash Stranger Fiction, supposedly you can leave me a voicemail or something. I don't really know, to be honest. He's emailing me, Jonathan at jonathanball.com. And yeah, let me know what other questions you need answered definitively for all time. And keep writing the wrong way.